How do you take criticism?
Not well.
I've never really been good at it until, I wouldn't say I've mastered it. I think I've gotten better. Over the last 6 years, I started to really like say, okay, let me not react to this criticism. Like, they probably have some good intention they're trying to tell me, and maybe there's some truth there. So let me start to listen to the feedback or the criticism and say, okay, how can I be better? Is there any truth in there that really resonates, or are they coming from a place of anger of their own thing?
Criticism is mostly fear-driven.
By the person criticizing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You criticize at a point of fact. You've been hurt. You've been disappointed. You've been frustrated.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of sayings that, you know, never take advice from anybody you wouldn't trade places with. Criticism is a form of advice. But you're afraid to tell people how to do stuff. So you just criticize what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, and then it becomes an addiction for some people. Criticism is not a great behavior. I know you've heard the phrase, nobody's doing better than you will ever criticize you.
Right.
They'll mentor you.
Right.
So, first of all, how do I take criticism? I got to take a step back and understand if somebody's coming at me with just a criticism, even if they ask permission to criticize, They got struggles that are worse than mine.
Right. If they ask you to give you criticism?
I'd be, you know, they're an open wound at that point.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Right.
They've already told me they're probably coming from a difficult place.
Gotcha.
So what I'm going to try to do is just kind of take it easy on them,
mm-hmm,
and understand where they're coming from. A blog I'm a big fan of, Eric Barker writes this great blog, yeah. Barking Up the Wrong Tree.
Yeah, that's great.
Eric told me one time, for every hater, there's going to be 10 people that are on your side. Mm-hmm. So when a critic comes up to me, I see that as there are 10 people. You're indicating to me that I'm successful with 9 other people, and I'm not going to get down on this person,
yeah,
because it's very easy to get down on them, because unfortunately they're coming from a negative place.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's good to know. What's a role-playing exercise that anyone could do with a friend that would make them a better negotiator?
Try to get whoever you're talking to say the magic two words, "That's right." Which means you got to summarize where they're coming from. In any given interaction, if you got a point you want to make,
yeah,
before you make it, your trigger, you're not allowed to make your point.
So give me an example. And you want the other person you're role-playing with to say, "That's right."
Okay, so you were telling me about critics.
Yeah.
You're a high-profile guy. You're about helping other people, which means you get criticized a lot.
That's right.
And when you get criticized, I wouldn't say you're empathic, although you are.
Mm-hmm.
I would say you're probably more compassionate. Those are two different things.
Mm.
Empathy is, you have to have empathy to be compassionate, but empathy is not compassion. Compassion is the next step. Empathy is a compassionate thing to do, genuinely understanding somebody. But there's a real fine line there. They're distinct things. And I think you have a tremendous amount of compassion for people. So you know that when someone criticizes you, they're attacking you.
Mm.
But you also know that they've been hurt and they're struggling. So you want to know how to respond to them and have them better as a result of the interaction, instead of coming back and making it feel worse. And you struggle with that because you're under attack.
Mm-hmm.
And you try not to fire back at them.
Right. Yeah, that's right. See, when I have a conversation with someone,
if you could summarize their point of view first. Summarize the other person's, when you summarize the other what the other person's struggling with.
In any type of deal making.
In any type of deal.
A business deal, a relationship, a buying coffee, upgrading, whatever it is.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Then after that, you can make your point.
Interesting. Make your point or make your proposal or...
Or whatever.
So if you're trying if you're trying to get an upgrade on an airport, on a plane or at a hotel.
Right.
Or trying to get a supersize made for free.
Right.
And you're trying to get some type of upgrade for free.
Right.
Would you do the same thing? Would you say, I know you're going through, it seems like it's been a long day for you.
Well, you can look at them and tell whether or not it's going to be a long day. So right off the bat, you say, long day?
Right.
And then as soon as you get ready to make your ask, what's their instinctive response, the knee-jerk reaction, what's that going to be?
When I make an ask?
Once you've made your ask, what's their, if somebody's trying to get something for free,
yeah.
What's their typical knee-jerk reaction?
Oh, this person's just trying to get something for free from me?
Right.
Yeah.
So.
And everyone does this or everyone.
There you go.
Everyone's doing this.
Yeah, so you walk up and you go like, hey, look, man, I know I'm going to seem like just another jerk who's trying to get something for free. Mm. Somebody who treats you like you're their servant.
Oh, man.
Somebody who doesn't care about you, could care less whether you live or die. They only care that you're alive long enough to make my coffee. Because that's what the other guy's thinking. Mm. How do you articulate what they're thinking, especially the negative stuff about you? When you say that, they're going to be like, No. But what you did was you just woke them up. Mm-hmm. You know, you snapped them out of the negative loop that's in their head. Because the last guy came in and said, yeah, I want a car. And I want it now. And I hate waiting in line at Starbucks.
Do you do this all the time, all day long? Are you constantly in a game of negotiation with people?
It's that, you know, that I brush my teeth today just because I brushed them yesterday. You know, I genuinely, I got to keep my skills up because it's either stay even, decline, or get better. I want to keep my skills up. The mercenary in me does it because I got to keep my skills up. The missionary in me does it because I actually care about people.
Yeah.
I just assume that you had a good day.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that you didn't, that my interaction with you didn't leave you worse. Mm-hmm. That my interaction with you left you better. Everybody we encounter should be left better by the interaction.
How important is the intention before you walk up to the coffee shop, before you go to the hotel, before you get on the phone with the other business owner to make a deal, before you have a conversation with your partner about where you're going to dinner? Do you set an intention first? Like walking into the hotel, you're like, this is what I'm going to say. This is the result that I want to get out of this. This is the way I want to leave people feeling.
The intention, the intention is, you know, I want you to have fun with the interaction. Mm.
The other person.
Yeah.
I want you to have fun.
If I'm playful, if I'm intending for you to have fun, you know, I'm in a department store.
Yeah.
I'm joking around with the guy behind the counter, and I go, tell you what, you know what? How about if you give me the employee discount?
Right.
Give me the employee discount. I'll say it like that. Give me the employee discount. And the guy in the store says, if I give you the employee discount, I'm going to have to pay for it myself.
Really?
And I go, I'll pay you back. I said it just like that. He went and he started walking around asking people how he could key it in and get me the same discount without having to pay it himself. He walked around the store for 10 minutes.
Really?
I saw him walk up to a manager. The manager shaking his head.
Yeah, he's going to someone else. Is it?
And then on his way back, another employee walked up to him on the side, whispered in his ear, and he went, okay. And he walked up, and I got 30% off.
Wow. But you didn't pay him back. It was just like a playful.
I was being playful about it, just being silly about it.
And what's the best way to get an upgrade at a hotel for you?
All right, so slightly different take on the approach.
Yes.
My son does this all the time. My son, Brandon, runs my business. He's our best negotiator. He prides himself when we all come into a hotel, he's got to be in a better room than me. And I'm the boss.
That's hilarious.
And as far as I'm concerned, I'm paying the bills.
Yeah, of course.
He got an upgrade in a hotel one time that I couldn't even get on the floor.
You need a special key.
Yeah.
Key code. Yeah.
Me and the other guys were going, hey, we'll come up to your room. He goes, I got to come get you. I said, no, we'll just come knock on your door. He goes, no, you can't even get on the floor I'm on. He paid less for his room than I paid for mine.
Wow.
And I'm the boss.
Wow.
But he'll walk up to somebody and say, I'm getting ready to make your day the most difficult day you ever worked here? And he says, because somebody works behind a counter at a hotel, I mean, God knows what they've seen. Oh, you know, have you got a head in the bag? Do you want to, are you going to have ritual sacrifice in a room?
Right.
You know, what have you done? You've done, because in a hotel, they've seen every kind of sort of crazy thing you could imagine. Mm-hmm. And they just go, oh, God, what is it? And he goes, I'm just going to be another self-centered person looking for a free upgrade. They're like, oh, my God.
That's it? Oh, yeah.
And they're immediately through the roof. And I start checking it in and listening. And they say, hey, you know what? Yeah, I tell you what. Let me give you this room. It's on the exclusive floor. It's in a presidential suite. President ain't coming, so I'm going to give you the president.
right.
I know the president ain't coming tonight. We're holding a suite for him just in case. You can have it. He's not going to be here.
Wow. I remember from our interview the last time, I think if my memory is right, you would say one of the strategies is leading with, like, being challenging in a certain way, or I'm going to be demanding a lot. Isn't that something that you talk?
Well, to a little bit, yeah.
Something,
you know,
that way, right?
I'm gonna if I know you're gonna react negatively to my ask, I will give you a preview that makes it look worse
than
what it's gonna be.
Yeah. So what do you call that framework?
For lack of a better term, it's emotional anchoring.
Emotional anchoring.
You know, we don't do price anchoring.
Uh huh.
You know, but we'll do emotional anchoring. If you're not going to like what I have to say, I'm going to say, look, you're not going to like this.
Right. That's what it is.
And then I'm going to shut up, because your amygdala is going to kick into gear and you're going to think that I'm going to insult you, your parentage, your family, your genealogy, your clothes, everything. Because the amygdala is going to go into overdrive.
Wow.
So whatever I ask for after that is going to be relief. And I'm doing that also because I need to keep an eye on how you feel when we're done.
Mm.
Not as much how you feel at the start, but how you feel when we're done.
So you want someone to be, it's okay if they start off in a lower energetic or negative attitude, as long as when you finish, they feel like, okay, it got better over time.
Yeah, you feel good at the end. The last impression is a lasting impression.
Interesting.
And that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
It's what we refer to as a law of gravity.
Huh.
It doesn't, you know, we have gravity. We can't explain why gravity works, but you're still not going to step off the balcony because gravity's there.
Right.
The last impression is a lasting impression, no matter what.
Mm.
So I need to, more than anything else, make sure that the last impression is positive, or at least feels collaborative.
Or you're a business partner with someone, or you've been in a long negotiation for 6 months with someone, either one.
Right.
You've been a business partner working together for a year or two, or you've been trying to find a deal with someone else for a year or two.
Right.
And
both, it's taken too long.
Both options have taken too long, that you haven't been getting the results you want, and you feel like you've been taken advantage of a little bit. Let's just say that. How do you, and it's going, it started off good and it's going the opposite way.
Right.
It's getting worse and worse. How do you finalize it so that it goes back to a high or a higher mark, leaving you feeling better and leaving the other person feeling better?
Or you get out of it.
Yeah, or you just get out of it. But you just say, okay, I'm done, bye, I don't want to talk to you. How do you not burn a bridge if you're in that situation?
I'd probably say something to the effect of, look, you're not going to like this.
Mm. So you start with the emotional anchoring.
Right.
Interesting.
This isn't working for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I can't do it anymore.
Mm.
And my problem here has been that I like you.
Mm.
I've always liked you. And the stuff that we've done together successfully has been phenomenal. And I would like nothing better than at some point in time in the future for us to be able to get back to that.
Mm.
But for right now, in order to preserve the memories of the positive things we've done, I'm out now.
Wow. How do I remember that? So every time I'm in a situation, I can say that same thing.
Well, it's a little bit of a sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And the sequence is, we need to stop what we're doing right now. But if we're going to stop what we're doing right now, what everybody thinks of is, where is this going in the future?
Mm.
So I gotta create a point in time for the future that we're both happy with.
So there's still a bridge.
There, you know, there's still an potential opportunity for the future.
Yeah, maybe it's a year. Maybe it's never going to happen, but you keep it open.
I'm open to it. I'm finishing positively, but I am finishing.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because the last two sentences, maybe even just the last sentence, are going to ring in your ears over and over and over and over. Because that's what your brain is always going to go back to, the last impression. How did I make you feel at the end? I make you feel valued. And you're going to appreciate the fact that I walked away without calling you names.
Mm.
But I walked away.
Right. It's hard to do.
Yeah. It's hard to get your practice in.
You got to do practice, yeah.
You know, you're working on it a few times. Most of the time what people have at the end is the battle for the last word is when the last word is a cheap shot.
Right.
That's when people...
Screw you too. Hang up. Right.
Right. And I'm going to call you back to say screw you right back. And then I'm going to hang up.
Yeah.
You know, there's a battle of the last word's a problem and the last word's a cheap shot. But when the last word is a positive thing, it's not a problem.
So always end in a with positive words.
Right.
Even if you feel taken advantage of, even if they hurt you, even if they screwed you over, whatever, you should always try to end in a positive way.
Yeah, without question. Because if you're talking to them, then your goal was to resolve things and to have a great relationship. Now, you might say that at the very beginning of the interaction, but it's more important to say it at the end.
Mm.
You know, my goal was always to have a great relationship with you. And if we can get out of this dynamic, that would be my goal again. But right now, I'm out.
Yeah.
But understand that at any point in time, when we can go back to working collaboratively, I'd love to do it.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And so usually what it is take what you said at the beginning and at least say it again at the end.
That's good. Yeah, I like that. What is something that you did as a hostage negotiator with terrorists around the world that you use today in just common interactions? Is there something that you did at the height of like this intense conversation that you do on a daily basis?
Pretty much everything we've been talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna make a verbal observation on how they're processing things. You know,
it feels like you'll say all those things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the bread and butter of great hostage negotiation.
Really?
Yeah.
It's having them be seen or heard.
Yeah.
Feeling understood.
You know, people are taking actions to make a point. What happens if you can make the point without taking the action?
They're taking actions to make a point.
Right.
And you're saying you don't need to take that action because I hear you.
Yeah, let me see what happens if I can, and it makes no sense at all. But I'm going to take probably 90% of a terrorist agenda away just by making him feel heard, making him or her feel heard. I'll deal with whatever I have to afterwards. But let's say I could only take away 10% of their agenda by making them feel hurt.
Yeah.
What if I could only take away 1% of their actions by making them feel hurt? That's worth the investment to me.
It's worth it.
Let me see what's left over after they feel hurt.
It's less fingers they're cutting off, less people they're blowing up, whatever, right?
Yeah, one way or another.
What's the best approach? Say I'm looking to buy a company, right? I'm looking to acquire something. I really like this software, this tool, this agency, I want to buy them. What's the best approach without seemingly or thinking like, oh, if I come to them like I'm too needy, I really want them, then I'm giving them all the power.
Right.
What's the best approach of someone that wants to buy something?
Yeah, completely counterintuitive. What are all their arguments for making you pay the high price? State them first. Because what that actually does is it leaves them with nothing to say.
So 8 Mile them.
Right? Very nice.
Right?
Exactly right.
8 Mile them.
Yeah, we used to use that clip from 8 Mile all the time.
So good.
Articulate everything they got to say.
So for instance, if I'm an agency, you want to buy me, right? My company.
Yeah.
What would you say? If I'm like, my business is growing, we've getting all this attention, we're helping clients with big results, we're growing as fast as possible, and you're like, wow, this company's really growing, we got to get them now before they're too big. What would you, call me up on the phone, do you write me an email, do you meet, hey, I want to meet for coffee, what's the best approach? In person, email, phone, video conferencing. If you could have it any way.
All right, I'd say, look, I'd probably say right off the bat, like I'm completely blown away with what you're doing. You guys are phenomenal. You're on the upswing. You guys are killing it. I'm going to seem like a cheapskate. I'm going to seem like I'm trying to get something for nothing.
So emotional anchoring.
Yeah. Is it a ridiculous idea for us to talk about you selling me your company?
Wow. Getting something for nothing? Is that what you said too?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Because I'd start off with appreciation.
Yeah.
I've lowered your expectations of me. Mm-hmm. And see, the last thing that I did also was I did what we refer to as a no-oriented question. Instead of saying, would you like to buy? Would you like to talk to me about selling your company? I'd say, is it a ridiculous idea for us to talk about you selling me your company?
And what if I say, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous?
And we're done. I never had a shot to begin with.
Oh.
See, this is about keeping me out of deals that either I'm never going to make or I don't want to make.
So it saved you 6 months of your life, potentially, in a two-minute phone call.
Right.
But if they say, yeah, we're growing super fast, it'd be hard for me to really want to sell right now, but, you know, if you made me a great offer, I'd be open.
Yeah, I'd say, sounds to me like there's just no way that I'll be able to ever make you happy.
Because I need a great offer.
Yeah. If you say something like that to me, what you're actually doing is trying to get a really high bid out of me to soothe your ego.
Mm.
You want to go back to the board, employees, and say, you know what? We're worth $150 million, and I turned it down.
Mm.
Because in 5 years, we're going to be worth $450 million.
Wow.
So that kind of a question is, you want to bid for me to make you feel good.
Mm.
You're not seriously going to, by laying it out like that, you're not seriously going to entertain selling.
What if you as a business owner were like, we really need something like this. We need an agency like this to help us grow. What if you're in a position like, we got to find an agency like this. If it's not this agency, someone close to it. In order to help us grow, would you say, okay, let me go look at the other options internally to yourself, or would you keep that one open so that you can potentially come back in 6 months if something happens? Or,
well, then the last thing I'm probably going to say is, how do I help you grow faster than you've got the means to get there on your own?
Mm.
You know, my guess is, based on your rate of improvement, what would you say is a high multiple of how much you guys are going to grow?
Mm.
How are you going to get there?
Right.
We have to start talking about, because now, and this is a typical dilemma for a lot of companies that are buying other companies. Because the company wants to sell today is more worried about today's price as opposed to the amount of money that they could be worth in the future. And they're leaving this future money on the table.
Yeah.
Like, let's say your company's worth $9 million. But you had a buddy sell his company for 12. So you're not taking less than 12 for your company. Now, it's worth 9. I can only buy it for 8.
Yeah.
But I can take you to 200.
That's interesting.
In 3 years.
So you got to show them the future potential as opposed to...
Now, the contrast, the fear of loss is our ultimate decision-making tool. People, most of the time, will sacrifice the future because of the present.
Mm.
But what you need to do is not sacrifice the future over the present.
Mm.
So I'll say to you, so $2 million today is worth more to you than $130 million in 3 years?
Wow, that's good.
And then you go like, wait a minute, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. So you need to reframe it for people.
Right.
Interesting.
Because people are almost always framed on the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Almost always framed on today as opposed to where could we be tomorrow. And this, a lot of what we're talking about today comes from stuff we've written in The Edge. Now, the first one, and Situation Drives Strategy, in immortal words of Brandon Voss, Situation Drives Strategy. No coincidence on the last name, by the way, for those of you that know. Had you given up on this project? I get communications on this all the time. I get a text, I can't remember if it was text or LinkedIn message the other day, maybe even Instagram. The guy says, this is just short of a magic spell.
Like, I get people to respond, and we cut the deal so much that it's like magic. It works so much. Situation drives strategy. You cannot ask somebody, have you given up on this project at the beginning of the conversation? It's out of context. It has, for it to be appropriate, for it to be authentic, it has to be on something they've already started, a communication you've already started. If I get a text message or an email from somebody and it's my first communication from them, and they basically say, have you given up on working with me? My answer then is yes, because you're trying to manipulate me with this question. I never started, so I never could have given up. And you, if you try that on me, you need to learn that situation drives strategy. It's out of context, and people won't trust you if it's out of context. They're going to feel like, even though they're saying no, there's something wrong with this. Maybe it works on people some. But if you're opening your communications with, have you given up on, I would ask you to rethink your approach to people. Come back, be a little more authentic, pull out of the manipulation. Have you given up on this project is for when people have ghosted you. When you're being ghosted, have you given up on this project is just darn near, not only it's close to guarantee, and nothing is guaranteed, but it's as close to a guarantee that they're going to respond to you. And on top of that, they're going to respond to you in 3 to 5 minutes of seeing it. And what we want you to know from the Black Swan Group is the system that you're using is perfectly designed to give you the outcome that you've obtained. What do I mean by that? If they're ghosting you, your communication strategy has led to them ghosting you if they've stopped communicating with you. People don't stop communicating if they feel listened to. One of two things is going on the other side, and it's probably a combination of both. You're not listening. You're pitching. You're explaining. Ronald Reagan said, if you're explaining, you're losing. And secondly, there's a really good chance that they're losing power and influence on their side. Thank you very much. I love the applause. For those of you that are applauding, much appreciated. So you've got to take into account that you have been listening to them, and they may be losing influence on their side, which embarrasses them. They don't want to admit that. That's one of the reasons they're going to stop talking to you. A lady I was advising on negotiations in the early days before the book came out, we hadn't proved this concept. She's selling this guy on an investment. She's running an investment fund, and it happens to be an NFL coach. And he's ghosting her. And I said, send him a text that says, have you given up on investing in a fund? And she's like, you know, I never heard of that. But what the heck? I got nothing to lose. He's not calling me back anyway. So she sends him the text message, have you given up on investing in the fund? He responds immediately. That's what they will do. And she goes back to pitching before, which caused him to stop talking to her in the first place because she was pitching. She was explaining. She wasn't listening. And it was the last she ever heard of him. This is the most powerful one-shot reset you are ever going to be given, ever. But if you go back to what contributed them to ghosting you in the first place, you've just blown your one-shot reset. What do you got to do when you reset? You got to get a that's right out of them. You got to demonstrate understanding. You got to make them feel heard. Give you another example. It's in the book, Never Split the Difference. Woman consultant, she's having a problem with a male CEO. She's perceiving that he's somewhat of a misogynist. He's giving her a hard time because she's a woman. He owes her money. He doesn't want to pay. He's making up all of these nonsensical excuses. We say, do two things. Send him a text saying, have you given up on settling this amicably? The version of, have you given up on this project? Now he's going to get back to you right away. And at that point in time, you have to be prepared with a summary to get a that's right out of him. Make him feel heard. Make him feel understood. Because it breaks down barriers. When you make somebody feel understood, when you get a that's right out of somebody, agreement is right around the corner. And the important thing about that idea right around the corner is you can't see it, but it's on top of you. It's right around the corner. Now, she doesn't think that he's going to call back right away because he's been so uncooperative and so hostile and so defensive and all this negative stuff. She's like, yeah, yeah, sure, sure. I'm going to send him the text just to prove that you're wrong and he ain't getting back to me. And she's not ready with a summary. Sends him the text. He gets back to her right away. The sound of his voice triggers her again. She's not ready with a summary, which, by the way, keeps you from being triggered. One of the reasons you want to summarize the other side is because it calms you down. Not because so much as it calms them down, but it calms you down. Even uttering an attempt at a summary of their perspective calms you down. It's incredible. She's not ready for this. His voice triggers her again. She gets mad and it goes down the tubes and she doesn't get paid. So haven't you given up on this project? Have you given up on settling this amicably? Have you given up on X? Whatever that is, they will respond and they are going to respond in 3 to 5 minutes. Again, this is to restart a communication and be ready with a summary, because if they stop communicating with you, it's a really good chance your communication strategy contributed to the problem. The system you're using is perfectly designed to give you the outcome that you've obtained.
Jack Welch, author of Jack and Winning, alongside with his wife, Susie. They're coming through Los Angeles a couple of years ago. They're hustling their book, The Real Life MBA. I go to the book signing Jack Welch is at. I want him to come speak to the negotiation course I'm teaching at the time at USC. How many people try to get Jack Welch to say yes to something at that book signing? Pretty much every one of them, right? They're going to come up there, Jack, how are you? My wife makes a great meatloaf. You want to come to the house tonight? God knows what they're going to ask him. Jack, I got this invention. Would you pose with it? How many people are going to ask him to try to say yes? That day, that week, how many people try to get Jack Welch to say yes to something? You're me. You come up to Jack Welch. What do you say? And how much time do you have? You maybe got 7 seconds. And even if you get to the second response after him, there's 300 people standing behind you in line. They walk you up there. Before you get to them, they say, what's your name? Chris. Write on a piece of paper so Jack doesn't get it wrong. Really, that's so you don't talk to him. And then you keep moving. On top of that, have they patted me down? Do they know whether or not I've got a gun? Have I been through a metal detector? As a matter of fact, I do have a gun, but he's not in trouble for me. They don't have my identification. They don't know I'm not going to hurt him. I'm going to get within arm's length of Jack Welch. Action is quicker than reaction. They can't stop me from doing anything I want to do. This is the dilemma of bodyguards. You get within arm's length of the target, you can only stop them after they've done it. You can grab them after they've killed your target, but you can't stop them. I'm going to get within arm's length of Jack Welch. I could do whatever I want. I could walk up to him and kiss him right on the lips if I want to, right? He was falling asleep. I want to make sure he's waked up. He's going to wake up screaming in the middle of the night tonight. Ah! I walk up to Jack Welch, and this is what I say to him. Is it a ridiculous idea for you to come and speak at the negotiation course that I teach at USC? He looks up and to the left, and gets this really intense scowl on his face. And he just freezes. And I think to myself, I just killed Jack Welch. He had a stroke. He's so furious. And he's going to die. And the security's going to tackle me. And they're going to drag me on cuffs. And I'm going to say, but I'm an FBI agent. And we don't care. He killed Jack Welch. So initially, when he doesn't die, I'm relieved. But he still doesn't move. But finally, he unfreezes. And he looks at me and he says, this is my personal assistant's name. This is a special Twitter account we have set up to communicate with her. I will call her and tell her who you are and what you want. I think we're going to be in Los Angeles in the fall. If we are, we'll come in and speak at your class. Calibrated no is worth at least 5 yeses.
Mixed-use building. This building is in a historic portion of this town. Marcella, are you still with me?
I am, and you're coming through clear.
All right. So it's in a historic district of town, which means nothing's going up. Nothing's going up. Nothing's coming down. 98% occupancy. People are lined up around the block to become tenants of this building. And it's for sale. As agents, what do you want to know right off the bat? 98% occupancy, lined up around the block, historic district in town, it's for sale. What do you want to know immediately?
Why is he selling?
Why is he selling? That's what our guy wants to know. Why is he selling? But our guy wants to know that despite the fact that he knows that why makes people universally defensive. He doesn't want to make the listing agent defensive, so he doesn't want to ask a why question. So what did he do? Was he intentionally mislabeled, or he labeled something that wasn't obvious. And he said, this, it seems like the seller must be trying to get out of the market due to disbelief in the future of the market if they're selling. The listing agent said, no, my client is underwater on several properties and he needs to start offloading immediately. Now, this being a mislabel invokes the law of negotiation gravity that says the desire to correct is irresistible. There's no way that the seller gave the listing agent that kind of, or the permission to release that kind of information to anybody. But the desire to correct this young, inexperienced agent overrode the best interest of his client. It felt better to correct this young agent with the right information than it did to protect the interest of his client. And so keep that in mind. You're going to be afforded opportunities where you can mislabel, intentionally mislabel a situation, an incident, or an event and get corrected with more truthful information. You get a less guarded response and more candid information when you are being corrected. So don't be afraid to actually label something that's not there, because they're going to correct you.
Summarize the situation. Summarize the situation from the other person's point of view. If you're summarizing and you've done it right, the other side is going to say, that's right.
You got to get them to say, that's right. Not your right. They say you're right when you've been pitching and they want you to shut up. Your right is secret code for please stop talking. We sort of joke around in my company, we say your right is code for F you. The 2 millimeter shift is describing to them, and this is what Mike was talking about earlier, discover what's important to them. How do you know when you've discovered it? When they say that's right, not your right. They say you're right when you're pitching. They say that's right when you reiterate it back to them what the world looks like to them. There's stuff here that you will never know unless they tell you. And they will only tell you after they've said that's right, and they will then correct you and let you know what matters to them, which is a lot quicker way than laying out a 10-point value proposition when only 3 of those 10 matter. Because all the time that you spent on the 7 of the 10 that don't matter are wasted time. And is what everybody else is doing to them. Does it work on sociopaths? This is an American that was kidnapped in the Philippines, and this is a sociopath that's got him. And this is a rape and kill and murder and head chop and terrorist, straight out of the movies. And this is the negotiator that I'm coaching. Now, our sociopath is calling for $10 million of war damages for 500 years of oppression, from the Spanish to the Japanese to the Americans. It's a smart move because it makes $10 million sound like not that much money. fishing harm, fishing rights violation, economic harm, everything that's happened over the last 500 years. Now, I realize right now you're tuning this out because you've never been in a discussion when someone was mad at you and they were bringing up things from the past that didn't have anything to do with you, did you? People don't do that. That's just crazy. Only terrorists do that. So we get into this and we go back and forth and finally we got to hit the reset button. This is what we refer to as the birth of the that's right moment, because I coach my guy to say, today all we're going to do is get the sociopath to say that's right. And you're going to summarize everything that he said and especially the bad stuff about us. That's where you're going to have trouble, because you only want to talk about the good stuff about you. But from their perspective, the bad stuff about us, and lay it on thick, because in this stuff, this tactical application of empathy, this tactical application of FBI empathy, if you're not laying it on thick, you're not laying it on thick enough. So we get on the phone with this guy. I'm coaching a negotiator, and I coached all over the world. That's what I did. I coached negotiations. And my guy lays it all out. 500 years of oppression, Spanish to the Japanese to the Americans, atrocities under Black Jack Pershing in the 1900s, violation of the fishing rights, economic harm, injustices, unfair. You're not Filipinos anyway, you're Moros. And you're being oppressed today by a puppet government in the Philippines that's held up by the last colonial power, which is the Americans. And he goes on and on and on. And finally, he gets done, there's a moment of silence, and a sociopath on the other end of the line says, that's right. And in that moment, we went from $10 million to zero. The ransom was never mentioned again through the duration of the kidnapping. It went away. It was just gone. Kidnapping took a couple more twists and turns. A couple months later, the American walks away. Jeff Schilling, the American, just walks away. Local farmer sees him walking down a dirt road. Sees, knows he's got to be Jeffrey Schilling because there ain't that many black Americans walking around the south of the Philippines. Says, you must be Jeffrey Schilling. Says, I am. They fly him back to Manila. The military, they hold a big press conference. President of the Philippines on one side, Secretary of Defense on the other side. Secretary of Defense says, in a daring rescue operation, we have rescued the American Jeffrey Schilling. We shot all these terrorists and they were mortally wounded. They went off into the brush and died. That's why we don't have any bodies to show you. But it was a daring rescue operation. Daring operation. They gave him a ride. And back in the Philippines, about 3 weeks afterwards, another kidnapping has gotten kicked off, and I connect up with my guy, and he says, you're not going to believe who called me on the phone. I don't know. The terrorist, the sociopath. He still knows my guy by his undercover names, got his undercover number. What'd he say? Have you been promoted yet? I don't know what it was he said to me on the phone. I was going to kill the American. You're really good. They should promote you. He hangs up. What's he saying in that moment? I felt respected by you. I'd deal with you again. That's what he was saying. He was telling him that if they had to deal with each other again, he felt respected enough that he would be willing to deal with them as a peer, peer-to-peer basis. Understand the terrorists got nothing. Nothing. His organization ended up in a shambles as a result of this. And he was still willing to deal with the guy that got the that's right out of him. Everybody you deal with, regardless of the outcome, should feel that way when they get done interacting with you. Now let's dive in. Number one. Is now a bad time to talk? Now, we're going to give you several no-oriented questions in a row because they're awesome and they help get you an advantage right away. But one of the things I'm going to underscore on these no-oriented questions is the issue of decision fatigue. Now, look, everybody's got the same problem. We all suffer from decision fatigue. You suffer from decision fatigue. What does that mean? What that means is there are only so many decisions you can make in a given day. There are only so many decisions any human being can make in a given day. That's one of the reasons why if you're in prison and you come up for parole, you want to come up for parole in the morning instead of the afternoon, Because in the afternoon, they're going to give you no decision. They're not going to be able to make a decision. You're more likely to stay in jail. This is not parole and parole board issues. This is human nature issues. There are only so many decisions. There are only so much gas anybody has in a tank to make decisions on a given day. And that's going to be a result of, you know, how much sleep they got the night before, what their diet is, what they ate that day, whether or not they ate carbs, where they are in their circadian rhythm. Everybody hits a circadian low roughly about 3 a.m. and about 3 p.m. Just part of being a human being. Decision fatigue issues. However, we found in a black swan group, through practice and application, that people are capable of saying no at pretty much any time of the day. I had an intern a number of years ago, only wanted to ask me how and what questions because he was horrified about making a mistake. Middle of the afternoon, he'd be asking me how and what questions, and I just didn't have the gas in the tank to answer him to be able to engage in that deep thinking, as Danny Kahneman would say. So consequently, I'd say, like, I don't know, don't bother me, leave me alone, instead of giving him an answer. Finally, I said, look, don't ever ask me a question after 1 o'clock in the afternoon where the answer isn't no, because I could say no and I can think through the next several steps and give him guidance. We've used this on a regular basis. You got to get into practice using no-oriented questions. And number one is the flip side of the most common thing you're saying on a regular basis, which is wrong. Actually, it's not that it's wrong. It's just not great. Is, have you got a few minutes to talk? Now, I know you mean that respectfully. And we're not throwing respect out the window here. The Black Swan method is actually extremely respectful. Is now a bad time to talk? Test drive it. Use it on a regular basis. Build your no-oriented questions, mental synapses, and experiment with the sort of answers that you get. You're going to like them. And as a side note, I would say to you, anybody that would say yes to that, do you really want to talk to them? Then, at that moment, when they've actually said yes to that, no, you don't. All right, number two, is it a ridiculous idea? Use this in place of, is it a good idea? For all the same reasons that I just gave you. You got to get your practice in. Number three, are you against XYZ, whatever it may be? Instead of, are you in favor of? Again, you've got to use this to get into practice. We had a woman at in a hospital services company once who was a little skeptical of our no-oriented questions approach, walked out of the room during the training and reached out to the head nurse in a hospital about a program that she'd been trying to get the head nurse to accept that the head nurse had been rejecting. Instead of saying, do you want to agree or would you like to do this? She said, are you against? And then asked the question. The head nurse immediately said no. They came to an agreement and they implemented the program. She came walking back in the room and said, you guys are not going to believe what just happened. I've been trying to get agreement on this for weeks and I switched from a yes question to a no question and cut the deal. Got to get your reps in. Number four, have you given up on X, whatever that X may be? This is context driven. What's the context? It has to be something they've already started on. Otherwise, you're using a black swan skill as a manipulative trap, which is not what we advise. They have to have already started on this. Now, when do you use this? You use this when they are ghosting you. They've gone silent on you. This will restart your conversation 999 times out of 1,000. Don't let the fact that it stops 1 in 1,000 times stop you, scare you. Nothing works all the time. This works more than anything else does. And what makes it work? Well, you got to keep this in mind. Your system is perfectly designed to give you the outcome you've obtained. If they've gone silent on you, you've been doing something to contribute to them going silent on you. You've probably been explaining.
You've probably been pitching. You've probably been educating. Gotta stop all these things. Restart the conversation with this one shot restart. And then your very next move is you got to get a TR out of them. What's a TR? That's right. How do you get a TR? How do you get a that's right? You got to summarize their perspective, particularly their reservations, their reasons for not doing it, what they're up against, the difficulty of what they might be facing, and then go dead silent. You do not go, but here's why those aren't good reasons. You got to go dead silent and get a that's right out of them. If you can't get a that's right out of them at that point, you've got to say, it sounds like I've left something out. That's a bonus response for you to use here, which is not on our top 10 list, but helps you get farther in your conversations. Number five, and we're going to get into the category here with letting out no a little at a time. A person that I consider a good friend and I'm really impressed with, Ned Colletti, former GM of the Los Angeles Dodgers. We were sitting around talking about negotiation one time. Ned is a phenomenal negotiator, and he told me the phrase, I like to let out no a little at a time. This is a great attitude. You do not want to let people get blindsided by you suddenly saying no. You've got to let it out a little at a time. And the first way of letting out no a little at a time in a highly collaborative way is, how am I supposed to do that? Now, many of you know this is one of the most famous lines with the Black Swan Method, and it's pretty much the opening story in the book Never Split the Difference. How am I supposed to do that? And we originally conceived of this as a way to passively say no, even passively aggressively, against the throat-cutting negotiators that are really trying to kick your backside. And what it is in many other ways is, it's an implementation question. How questions are about implementation. It's designed to let the other side realize that there's some implementation issues here. This also falls in the category of what Brandon Voss has labeled forced empathy. It forces the other side to take a good, empathic look at your situation. We use empathy because it works, and we use empathy because we want to get it in return. You're going to use empathy because it works, and you're going to use empathy because you want it in return. And how am I supposed to do that is a great starting point for that. Now, what happens if they turn around and say, well, that's your problem? Will they put it right back on you? Which will happen occasionally. Once had a woman say, I used how am I supposed to do that, and it didn't work because they shot back right at me and told me how I was supposed to do that. Well, number one, the fact is it's not that it didn't work. The fact is that it's giving you a better, clearer picture of the situation. They throw it right back on you. They're telling you they're not interested in showing you any empathy. That's an interesting clue that maybe you don't want to do business with them. All right, I'm going to give you two ways to subscribe to the Black Swan Group's negotiation newsletter, which is free. It doesn't cost you anything. I had a colleague with the FBI that used to like to say, if it's free, I'll take three. Here's how you subscribe to The Edge if you're in the United States. If you're not, I'll give you a method right afterwards. Send the text to, the number is 33777, that's 33777. The text message that you send is Black Swan Method to 33777. It's concise, it's actionable. That's the most important parts of this, concise and actionable. Comes to your email inbox on Tuesday mornings when you're ready to rock and roll and get after the week. Now, if you're not inside the United States, you see the Black Swan website, the homepage. You go up on the right-hand side here on this menu here, you see blog, click on that. Bang, you're at the negotiation edge. On the right-hand side right here, subscribe. First name and email, sign up now. There's a ton of free information on this site, on the Black Swan Group website, home. Look at it, get everything free that we have. If it's free, you should take three. And in the model of letting out no a little at a time,
here's the next no that you let out, which is number 6 on our list. And it is, your offer is very generous. I'm afraid that just doesn't work for me. Now, here's the beauty aspects of this. You mentioned generous. You want to encourage generosity on their part. That's a good thing for you to throw into this statement. Second part, it just doesn't work for me. That removes the problem of external criteria. Now, my academic brothers and sisters like to talk about, well, let's agree on an external criteria. Why should you agree to the external criteria? Maybe the external criteria is okay and appropriate in a neutral situation or in situations other than yours. Well, why should external criteria apply to you? In many cases, it doesn't. You want to remove an agreement on external criteria from the conversation because they're only going to agree to external criteria that works against you, and you don't want to put yourself in that corner. This is a great way to come back with a much stronger no. One of the students in our class at Georgetown said they use that phrase, your offer is very generous, but I'm sorry, it just doesn't work for us. And he said the people on the other side of the table looked at each other and then looked back at him and said, you're right, it is high. Now that's an interesting response because you want to have an impact on what you say. What you say and what they hear. You want them to get across in their brain. If stuff doesn't work, there's a pretty good chance it's too high. You don't want them to feel backed into a corner when you're letting out no a little at a time. And this is a great way to do that. Don't back people into a corner. They will disagree even when it's not in their interest to disagree. Taking away their autonomy is a bad idea, and that's what happens when you back people into a corner. Now, number 7. This is another counterintuitive response, and you use it for when somebody calls you and says, how are you today? Instead of saying, fine, you know, how are you? Or my back hurts, or it's a wonderful day. When they're calling you and saying, how are you today? What are they really trying to find out? Well, they're really trying to find out, are you in a mental place to talk about what I want to talk about? So here's how you short circuit this conversation in a way that builds rapport, that they appreciate, gathers information, and preserves your most precious commodity and theirs, which is time. It sounds like you've got a place you want to start. They are going to love this. Of course they have a place they want to start. They've thought about it before they called you. Now, every now and then, somebody's going to say to you, yeah, I do have a place I want to start, but I really want to know how are you today. Cool. Then engage in the conversation. And then you can get back to the place they wanted to start. Everybody wins. Number 8, another counterintuitive response. And this is how you should respond to questions when you're asked a question. So the first way to respond to questions, and number 8 on our list, is what makes you ask? Just like that. Now, when somebody asks you a question, what's more important is the question behind the question. What makes you ask? For 2 reasons. Number 1, most people are not good at asking questions. That question may be a result of a committee decision. You know how good a committee is? Well, let me give you an example. A giraffe is a horse designed by a committee. So committee decision questions are going to be off. On number 2, what's really driving at what make them ask is far more important than what they actually asked. So you got to find out, and this is not disrespectful. They're going to be happy to tell you. And if they're not, well, that tells you a lot about them too. And how can you respond if they say, just answer the question? Your response is, I want to make sure that I
answer what you're really asking me. I'm just trying to dial in to what you're really after. More respect. If they don't like respect from you, that tells you a lot about them and whether or not you should continue to be in business with them. Now, what happens if it's the middle of the afternoon, they're decision fatigued, they're having trouble coming up with an answer, it's too in-depth? The alternate to great calibrated questions and what makes you ask is a calibrated question. You want to ask an alternative label, an asking label, if you will. And so number 9 on our list is the alternative to what makes you ask. And that is, it seems like you have a good reason for asking that. Or, it seems like you have a good reason for asking that. I gave you both inflections there. Make sure you shut the front door right after you use that label. What does that mean? Go silent. Count thousands to yourself if you have to. Let them break the silence. You won't get past 3. Be prepared to count to 10. And wait. Respectfully. This is a respectful dynamic. And respect is one of your best choices. Finally, number 10. On the top 10 list of black swan negotiation bullets. You're going to use this when the other side is failing to perform. When they're not living up to an agreement. What do you say? It seems like you have a reason for not doing. And then whatever it is that they didn't do. X, Y, perform. Finish the contract, finish the work, call me back. They're going to have a reason. They're probably afraid to tell you. This is the best way to re-engage a collaborative approach to whatever the problem is so that they feel safe and respected. Always the keys to a long-term relationship.
We are trying to accomplish a couple of things with the use of tactical empathy. First is to build and maintain relationships. This is the fastest way to build and maintain relationships. There is a thought process out there. There are people that subscribe to the theory of common ground. Many people try to establish and maintain relationships with common ground. And I'm not here to tell you that common ground is not a, I'm not here to tell you that common ground is a bad approach. There are many who have established relationships and made deals based on common ground. However, you have to ask yourself, what are you going to do if that's you? What are you going to do if there's no common ground? What if you got no common ground with the people that you're dealing with on the other side? What do you do then? This is where tactical empathy comes in. I don't need common ground. I had no common ground with anybody I ever talked to inside a crisis site who had taken hostages or were threatening to commit suicide or otherwise failing to surrender. Never had any common ground. And yet, was successful in influencing surrender in the majority of the cases that were out there. Why is that? It's because common ground or not, tactical empathy is something that can be used in any interaction, business, personal, or otherwise. Common ground is usually specific to the situation. And so just be careful with your use of common ground. Number one, you're making an assumption if you use it. You're making an assumption that just because you have common ground with this other person, they're going to do what you need them to do. And for some people, that assumption is a dangerous one. As a cop, when I was on the road, and I would see a vehicle violate a traffic law and I light the person up and I pull them to the side of the road. It used to drive me crazy when the first thing that comes out of the window before I even approach the car is a badge. Now a badge is hanging out of the window of this violating vehicle. He is all, or she has already made an assumption that just because we have common ground, i.e. we both carry badges, that I'm going to give them special dispensation. And usually it was the opposite. When you've already made an assumption about what I intend to do based on the fact that we have common ground, I found it offensive. I had one guy, I pulled him over. As I'm approaching the car, there's a badge hanging out the window. It's a federal badge. I can see that as I'm approaching the car. And the badge, it said, Special Agent Housing and Urban Development. And I said, that ain't going to cut it, bro. That ain't going to cut it. And so just be careful with the common ground. Because if it's not there, you're going to be in trouble. And number two, people often take offense at you suggesting that, oh, your son plays baseball, my son plays baseball. We should make a deal. Don't assume that that's always going to be the case.
We have a couple of questions come up. Do we want to go back to the label questions?
Sure, they have label questions, sure.
Okay. So one question is from Ivan. I'm not sure. I hope that's right. So she's asking, can you use it when negotiating promotion? So she said, for example, seems like you do not feel like I'm ready for the promotion, or seems like you would prefer this person get a promotion and not me. So she's wondering what the best way to use that would be without being pushy.
I think both of those labels are appropriate. Labels can be used in any situation just about, okay? As long as you're using a good label and you're not labeling something that's gonna come across as, you know, rude or purposely to make someone defensive, I think you're gonna be fine. Every personality type, every negotiator personality type responds well to labels, okay? All three of the types, accommodator, assertive, analyst, all of them like labels. So no matter who you're dealing with on the other side of the table, a label will be fine. Just monitor your tone of voice. Make sure you put it out there very, you know, matter-of-factly, especially with the, what was the first label again?
Seems like you do not feel like I'm ready for the promotion.
Right. So soften that up just a hair and say, seems like there may be a feeling that I'm not ready for this promotion. That way you're not singling out that one person that you're talking to. And instead of saying, it seems like you don't feel like I'm ready for this, it seems like there may be a feeling that I'm not ready for this. That way you're not pointing specifically at that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would just, if I can add something real quick, yeah, Sandy. For example, if you're wondering like, why am I not being promoted, right? You can use a label to try to understand that as well, right? Like, seems like there's something impeding this promotion. Seems like there's something, right? Like there's some kind of obstacle. So you can address that, and then you'll get to the bottom of maybe why you're not getting the promotion in the first place. One more question. Sorry, that fluffed. Okay. There's one, what if you're clearly being disrespected? So like if someone's like staring at your chest, for example, instead of talking to you in your actual eyes, face. She said, for an example, seems like you're being a pig. Is that a bit harsh?
Yeah, that's a bit harsh. You want to point it out, but you don't want to point it out by actually calling them a name. So what might be better is it seems like something in our conversation is distracting you. And in other words, I know that you're distracted by this and you shouldn't be distracted by this. So I'm going to point out that I know you're distracted, and maybe that'll bring your eyes up where they're supposed to be. So remember, you're not just actually labeling how you feel about them. You're labeling the dynamics of the situation. So if you have someone that's constantly looking at your chest, you can say, it seems like you may be a little distracted, because then when you're looking right at them and they look at you and they know they've just looked up, they're going to be like, oh, you know, caught red-handed. So, and you might even follow that up with another label saying, you know, it looks like we need to kind of regroup and get back on track and, you know, do it that way. But be careful being quite so blunt and honest. Look for more of the situation that's happening there and kind of label that, they know what they're doing. Okay. That pig knows what he's doing. He knows he's looking at your chest. He's not stupid. He knows he's looking at your chest. So when you say, seems like you may be a little distracted, and you're looking right at him with a question mark, like, are you distracted? And he's going to look up and realize that he just got snagged. Okay. So you want to point it out, but you don't want to, and this is the problem that some women face. When you speak up for yourself, you're automatically categorized as an assertive bitch. And you shouldn't be. So using the labels in a more subtle way will break away from that. And keep in mind, using labels is cumulative. In other words, it's not a one and done skill. Sometimes you have to do it 3 or 4 times to get an idea across. But if you stay in the proper mindset, if you stay curious about why are they acting the way they're acting, and it may be because they're a pig, but you don't necessarily want to point the finger at that right away. They're that way because that's the way they feel like they can act somehow or another through their life somewhere. Someone has given them the permission and told them that it's okay to do that. You don't have to put up with that. You can call them on that. You can say, seems like you're finding something else more fascinating. And I mean, look down like you know where they're looking, and you don't have to point out and say, stop looking at my breasts, you know, and be obvious about it. But you can basically put out there, you know, seems like you're too busy focusing somewhere else. Looks like we need to refocus on what we're doing. And just be a little more subtle about it. Do it with a smile on your face. Stay in that accommodator voice, because then it's not threatening to them. And you're not going, seems like you're too busy looking at my breast, you know, because then they're going to get defensive. And when they get defensive, you're automatically a bitch in their eyes, even when you've done absolutely nothing wrong. So the way
I mean, to that point where it's like, okay, I, you know, hate the idea that like we always have to be smiling or whatever, right? Ultimately, it's just when you're attacking someone. So if like you're essentially calling that person a name, it's just always going to be counterproductive. Does that person deserve it? Sure. That's not what we're talking about, right? Of course they do. But the problem is, it's like, if I want to have a working relationship with this person, if it's going to be more beneficial for me in the long run, which most of the time it is, then I need to understand how to actually make this productive. And so calling out behavior rather than name calling is going to be the more productive route.
Absolutely.
And then Dion had a question, which is, how is it bad to come across as bitchy?
Bitchy. I'm not going to say that it's never okay to be bitchy, because I mean, you know, I'm bitchy a lot. I'm just going to be honest with you. It just has to be done in an appropriate place, in an appropriate way. And when you're in a business negotiation situation or dealing with something at work, you can regulate yourself. You can control yourself and how you act and what you say. You cannot control the other side and what they do. However, you can have an influence on them by the way you use your tone of voice, by the way you hold yourself, and by the way you project yourself. So if you are dealing with someone on the other side of the table who is assertive, if you go at them assertive, which pretty much is bitchy, clash, and you're not going to be able to work it out. Okay. The best way is to go to tactical empathy first, you know, figure out why they're acting like they are. And most of the time it's just because they're being a jerk. So you have that and you understand that. So when you understand that, it's going to help you center yourself a little bit more, not react to that piggish behavior, and instead label that behavior and try to divert it a little bit.